And now we're going to move on to our second presentation for today. Natalia Pinzon specializes in agroecology as a means to reduce on-farm and global climate risk. As a PhD candidate in geography at UC Davis, she focuses on how California farmers are preparing for, responding to, and recovering from wildfires. Her action research project involves the development of a hybrid online and in-person course, Farming Through Wildfire Season. This multi-sector collaboration includes a guidebook for farmers on how to evaluate agricultural risk to wildfires. As a Colombian immigrant working in three continents, she has seen the diversity of ways that farmers and peasants are impacted by and responding to climate change. In partnership with renowned agroecologist Dr. Clara Nichols, she designed an award-winning course to support farmers through agroecological climate resilience planning. Now, she is developing an online course with the University of California called Climate Change in Agriculture. Natalia partners with community organizations across the state and the Americas who serve structurally disenfranchised farmers. This includes work to serve Latinx farmers, farm workers in California, organic seed producers in the United States, urban BIPOC farmers, and agroecology more broadly throughout Latin America. As a biologist and science education specialist, Natalia has created three web-based learning communities, built 30 online curriculum modules, and led 4 online certificate programs, which have supported over 1,500 multicultural farmers. She is the co-founder of Farmer Campus, an online school and learning hub for farmers. Welcome, Natalia. Thanks so much for presenting today.
Thank you, Anne, for that introduction, and thank you, Donnell, for a great presentation. I wanted to start by sending my solidarity to my compatriots in Colombia, who right now are at the front lines. With deep respect for farmers there, I want to recognize that much of this work comes from and is inspired by them. I'm here with you to share what we've learned from our work throughout the Americas in climate resilience planning using an agroecological approach. Like Anna said, I'm based in California, where I run an organization called Farmer Campus. We're an online learning hub for farmers where we teach courses on climate, wildfires, and financial resilience. I also conduct research through the Sustainable Food Systems Lab in the Geography Graduate Group at UC Davis. And my current work is on wildfire risk management and recovery in California. But much of what I'm sharing today comes from the research that we've been collecting through the AGRES, the Iberoamerican Agroecology Network for the Development of Agricultural Systems Resilient to Climate Change. Through this network, agroecologists have been systematically studying farming systems across the Americas after a climate disaster, such as a drought, a flood, hurricane, or a mudslide, to see what practices and what types of systems have been able to withstand and recover from a climate extreme event. We've been implementing risk assessment and planning through this initiative, and I'm here to share with you some of our approach. We've been thrilled, actually, to find a strong correlation between agroecology and climate change resilience through this research. Agroecological farms, which protect soils, integrate principles of diversity, nutrient cycling, conserve water, minimize external inputs, and support the social cohesion of producers. Those agroecological farms around the world have shown a remarkable capacity to withstand and recover from a climate event. And agroecology reminds us that an agricultural system is inextricably linked from its social, economic, and political context. Therefore, we design farming systems and assess risk and plan with these three dimensions in mind at all times, the ecological, the social, and the economic. One component that connects all three dimensions is diversity. Growing evidence that diversified farming systems provide greater adaptive capacity by improving both ecological and economic resilience. Diversity includes the consideration of the landscape matrix and fostering of ecological diversity, which supports synergistic interactions. This in turn supports market diversity. This last year, we conducted a study on how the pandemic impacted farms in California and found that those with higher crop diversity were actually more able to recover, and some even had higher revenue than in prior years. So through this work, we found that when identifying the climate risk of a farm, three important components need to be considered. First, the climate threat, its frequency, its intensity, and its duration. And by climate threat, we mean events such as a flood, a hurricane, or a drought, or a wildfire, so on. And identifying that threat, we can do with the climate tools like Danelle just shared. And then the second factor is vulnerability, or the aspect that makes it more or less susceptible to that threat, such as landscape and vegetation matrix, soil health, soil cover. We just saw the example of no-till, soil organic matter, slope and exposure. And third, response capacity, such as a farmer's knowledge of response strategies, access to resources, and access to a diversity of enterprises. We can think of risk as the existing vulnerability or weakness of the farming system multiplied by the threat over the response capacity. Therefore, the risk increases as the response capacity decreases. When planning for climate risk, we consider the existing weakness of the farming system, as well as the actions that can increase its response capacity. In brief, climate resilience, in its most simplest form, I think can be thought of as the capacity of a farm and a farming system to withstand a measure of its vulnerability and recover, or a measure of its response capacity from a climate event. So it both withstand and recover. So with that context, let's begin, let's get into the key components of agroecological resilience planning for climate events. I'll share with you a four-step model and process that we've been implementing in both North and South America, and we hope that it can be adapted to your local context. So beginning with the first step of identifying the climate threat and its associated impacts. This might seem simple on the surface, but can quickly lead to a lot of unknowns and nuance. For example, in California, drought is one of the biggest challenges. We're currently in a historic drought year. However, one of the producers I work with is living in a microclimate that's unique from any other of his neighbors. While they certainly experience drought and heat waves, they experience flooding and frost with some frequency. They've told me that their biggest climate challenge is not drought because they've built their soil organic matter and they can retain a lot of water. Rather, it's large temperature swings throughout the day because of their topography. All of this to say that to identify the threat, the local knowledge and local context is really important. Sometimes the impacts are so difficult to identify. For example, in our work with wildfires, we're only just starting to understand how exactly fires are impacting farms. Farmers have told me that a fire weather is leading to a surge of pests and cold spells right after a large wildfire. And we're slowly understanding the impacts of smoke pollution on different crops. Some farms have told me that they experience blackened eggs for months after a fire. So when dealing with climate events where there's little knowledge, having learning networks where farmer-to-farmer knowledge exchange is happening is extremely important, since that information isn't published or easily available. When it is published, research can really help us gather this information, but also guide us in understanding the potential impacts. And finally, climate tools, such as those of the climate hubs we just learned about from Danelle, allow us to see historic and future climate impacts to our region and to our crops. Next, we identify what actions can lead to reducing those risks from the climate threats that we just identified. So in continuing with the previous examples, we can use ecological corridors to bring natural predators to support unexpected pest outbreaks after a wildfire. We can include hedgerows to reduce the impact of winds and stabilize microclimates. Perhaps we can even create a temporary space that filters smoke for laying hens during wildfire season. In the second step, we'll identify what practices are indicators of vulnerability across three dimensions: the dimensions of ecological, economic, and social. So in the first, in the ecological, these indicators are highly context-specific, but we have seen some recurring patterns. For example, common ecological indicators of vulnerability are a lack of genetic, crop, and landscape diversity, or depleted and unprotected soils. Many producers have shared with me that soil health through soil cover, soil organic matter, and reduced soil disturbance is the number one reason why they're successfully farming and are a successful business within a drought region here in California. Other ecological indicators include water harvesting or having a landscape matrix surrounding the farm, which stabilizes microclimates, reduces wind, and supports biological corridors. These indicators are both context-dependent, but they're also threat-dependent. For example, the threat of a wildfire makes topography and slope an extremely important factor of risk. And unlike other climate threats, the surrounding landscape matrix can increase wildfire risk if there's a high fuel load from a forest surrounding the farm. So once indicators have been identified and the threat has been identified, then a description of each indicator is written. Through working with producers on drought indicators, we identified that a farm with more than 5 crop species was far less vulnerable than one with a single crop species or variety. Likewise, a farm with 50 to 70% soil cover and 4 to 5% organic matter had a low vulnerability to drought when compared to a farm with completely uncovered soil and much lower organic matter. So I can't emphasize enough the importance of doing this in a participatory way with producers. Okay, now let's take a look at economic indicators, such as diversity of markets and the turbulence of those markets. For example, markets that are susceptible to a globalized market economy would be a turbulent market. Access to loans as an economic indicator is also really important. Access to credit, capital, and insurance. Also, the dependency on external inputs, which makes farms more vulnerable in a globalized economy, as we saw in the pandemic, is an important indicator. Land tenure and labor. These are especially huge risks in California. Risk factors can have cascading impacts. For example, depending on a single crop or a farm product can mean over-reliance on a single market and supply chain, which can lead to catastrophic losses if at any point in the supply chain it's broken. We saw this in the dairy sector during the pandemic. So a lack of tenure can also prevent farmers and ranchers from investing in the ecological services of their farm, which leads to an increased ecological vulnerability. So this is how the cascading effects can happen. Finally, but not least, certainly not least, social indicators. These include the knowledge and skills around how to respond to the climate threat. It includes the social cohesion and organization of the agricultural community. We've seen this factor be of great importance in nearly all of the threats that we've worked with, and in the north and in the south. Nearly every farmer that I've interviewed in our wildfires work has said that social networks and social support systems are the single most important factor that allowed them to continue farming, especially farmers that didn't have insurance. Catastrophic losses from extreme climate events can be traumatic, and they can lead farmers to experience mental health challenges such as depression, as one farmer who we talked to suffered 2 consecutive losses shared with us. This is where kinship networks and social cohesion are so important. Institutional support includes relationships with NGOs and government agencies that can give funds and support after an event. And with the rising population of migrant farmers, I believe that language and cultural fluency and immigration status can make a difference between surviving in agriculture and not surviving. So this would be an important indicator as well. All 3 dimensions of resilience are integrated, as I said earlier. And there's excellent documentation on how farmer-to-farmer education and experimentation leads to ecological and economic innovation and ultimately climate resilience. The social supports the economic and the ecological. I highly recommend learning about the peasant-to-peasant movement and La Via Campesina, which is here on the bottom right-hand image. They've been well documenting the links between climate resilience and social cohesion. We've seen examples in the north as well, such as through Liz Carlisle's work in the Great Plains, where grain farmers who, through learning networks and cooperatives, transformed their farming practices. And as a result, they didn't even feel a historic drought that brought many of their neighboring grain farmers in that region to ruin. Once the indicators of vulnerability and resilience have been identified across these 3 domains, the third step is to take the pulse of the farm using these indicators. To do that, we select which factors are relevant to our farm or to our farming region if we're working on a regional level, and we identify the different levels of vulnerability across each of those factors. Continuing the example of drought risk that we looked at earlier, we could look at crop and genetic diversity, soil quality, water use and conservation. land tenure and markets as indicators of vulnerability, where, for example, a producer with a short-term lease under 10 years would be far more vulnerable than one who owns land and has the capacity to lease more land as needed. Then indicators of response capacity could include knowledge and skills of adaptation practices, low dependence on external inputs, social cohesion and organization, access to institutional support, practices that enhance ecological services, and access to a diversity of labor pools and backup labor. This table was developed for a regional assessment where multiple farms participated in its creation. If one or more of these factors are not relevant to their particular enterprise, or others are more important, some farms would then need to adjust their list depending on their context. We found that participating in a community process of risk assessment can be fun and can foster creative problem solving. So then once we've created our indicators and the different levels of vulnerability for each indicator, we then map out the results. This is what we call an amoeba diagram, which looks at, in this example, it's looking at two dairy farms, an innovative farm and a conventional dairy, as they're calling it. The outer dotted line is where the optimum state is, or the least vulnerable state. And each point on the graph is one of the indicators that were identified in the previous steps. This diagram will allow us to quickly see what areas are weak and strong in the two dairies. This is just one way to diagram the pulse of the agroecosystem, but it's helpful to visualize the overall state of the farm across those three dimensions in whatever way you choose to diagram it. In the fourth and final step, we reflect on the previous steps and look at the areas of greatest vulnerability to a particular climate threat. Then we plan on implementing strategies that reduce those risks. For example, going through a process of emergency response planning could be a step that's added to one of these strategies. Our plans really include actions that can be taken in the short, medium, and long term. It's important to list the costs or resources that are needed. That could be the number of hours, personnel, or actual dollar costs. In another planning approach, we list out the high priority actions that are pending or actions which will lead to the greatest risk, how specific actions will be taken, when, or the time frame for completion, and the estimated costs in terms of time, resources, or money. I also want to note that scenario planning is another approach that could be included here, as Danelle mentioned. In fact, listed as one of the priority actions in a plan like this. We found great benefit from an iterative process where assessing or taking the pulse of the farm, as we call it, happens regularly, say once a year. And then the plan is updated and implemented in the cyclical process of review. This allows for reprioritizing as new risks arrive and for celebrating what's been done. In summary, agroecological resilience planning involves first identifying the threat. In this example, we can see wildfires as a threat. Then we identify the areas that lead to greatest risk through vulnerability and response capacity. And then we make a plan to reduce that risk. Here we can see that for wildfires, the magnitude of the threat on the left and on the slope and surrounding landscape, such as being at high elevations in a wildland-urban interface, as many small farmers in our region are, as well as the likelihood of power shutoffs or evacuation and smoke in my particular region. These are the threats. The vulnerability is determined by managing the fuel loads in the surrounding forest landscape, creating defensible space, practicing emergency preparedness, access to animal evacuation infrastructure, and the market context of the farm. The capacity of the farm to respond on the right can be increased by having a financial safety net, including adequate insurance and access to loans, social cohesion with mutual aid networks, agency personnel relationships, and family and community support, as well as access to backup and fallback systems in the event of a fire or power outage, and high personal and workforce capacity. While this list is far from exhaustive, these components, when they're taken together as a whole, determine the overall wildfire risk of the farm or ranch during and after a wildfire. Once these key areas are identified, the producer, or ideally the whole farming community, can create resilience plans to reduce their risk to wildfire. Now, I just want to take a step here to note that resilience happens across scales. While the individual farm and enterprise scales can be specifically supported, as we've been reviewing in the last few slides, they're linked to higher scales, including the multi-farm or landscape scale, the network or community scale, and the public scale. Wildfires are really a strong reminder for us of how actions to reduce risk on one farm can be futile if it isn't a risk reduction that happens on the community or network scale, and if there isn't policy change at the public scale. Wildfires offer us an opportunity to rethink resilience. In fact, this concept of resilience has been heavily criticized for its support of the status quo. If we move into a system that depends on a vulnerable workforce and makes small farming enterprising exceedingly difficult, then we risk perpetuating the problem. And oftentimes, as farmers have shared with me many times during the wildfires, they're put in a place where they're self-exploiting in order to be quote-unquote resilient during a crisis. Therefore, it's important to ask, resilience for whom and resilience for what? We can perhaps think of a transformative resilience where the systems and the structures themselves transform to both reduce risk and increase equity. This is where working on resilience across the multiple scales become necessary. So with that, I want to thank you for this invitation, and a special thank you to Joanne Warner at the Western Center. And thank you to my team, my advisors, and our farmers and our funders. Feel free to write me if this information was interesting to you, or if you have any questions, you can write me directly. And I'll pass it back to Anna to lead us through the discussion.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Natalia. What interesting work. A big thank you again to both of today's presenters.